From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Well, it's on.
The House of Representatives moving forward with an official impeachment inquiry.
2 years, 8 months, and 5 days into President Trump's presidency, Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi made that announcement on Wednesday.
The president must be held accountable. No one is above the law.
What does it mean? We go to Philadelphia and speak with Professor Tony Montero to find out. I'd love to get your take on this. We can start, I guess, with that press conference with the newest president of Ukraine. He is like Trump. He comes out of a TV background. In fact, his last job was playing the president of Ukraine on a TV sitcom where it very closely resembled his current circumstances by which he got his job. And he did not give the Democrats what they had wanted. He said, essentially, nobody pressured me to do anything.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, he didn't give the neocons what they wanted.
Right. That's right. That's right.
Let's start with Zelensky. He's elected this year.
Right.
And he was not expected to win. He beat Poroshenko, who was a sitting president, and he beat him by 15 points. Poroshenko right. got 15% of the votes, and Zelensky got 30%.
Right.
No one expected that. Now, having said that, it must be recognized that the Ukraine is divided, and the election was pretty much a Western Ukraine affair. But
right.
this guy, Zelensky, represents not only a person who wants to clean the swamp of corruption in the Ukraine, and we got to get back to that because that's where Biden
that's
comes
right.
in.
Right.
But he seemingly wants some kind of detente or rapprochement with Russia, which overturns,
right.
Frankly, the whole reason for the 2014 coup d'etat itself.
Right.
Which gets us back then to the Obama administration and to Hillary Clinton, Samantha Powers, Susan Rice, and Victoria Nuland.
And the relationship of the United States to Russia, in essence, whether it's going to be, you know, Cold War 2.0 or something
Absolutely.
Different. Right.
Absolutely. Yep. The coup was part of a set of events which would lead to a color revolution in Russia and the overthrowing of Putin. Now,
right.
Trump's election throws a monkey wrench into all of that because Trump runs on, and as he tries to govern, and he's been thwarted in this, he wishes to establish detente with Putin's Russia. That is one of his major crimes. Now, Joe Biden, in the spring of 2014, only months after what many call a fascist-led coup d'etat in the Ukraine, where hundreds of people are killed, the trade union headquarters are burned down,
with people in it.
And hundreds of people burned to death. Yeah. In the place, and they let them die. It's a terror campaign. Now, Joe Biden, when he sits down with the Council on Foreign Relations and brags about his telling the Ukrainian government to get rid of the Attorney General in the Ukraine, what he is saying is, we are the ones that made it possible for you guys to come to government, for the coup d'etat to be successful. And now we're demanding that you do something for us.
Right.
That is the depth of the corruption.
Right.
Now, you know, this whole thing of now we're beginning an impeachment of Trump based upon what is the real intent of the anti-Trump forces within the neocon establishment, which is the majority of the establishment on foreign policy, is about foreign policy anyway. That's where it started, and this is where we are today. All of this other stuff about emoluments and I don't know all the other stuff that they have been talking about is just window dressing. And so they are going to try to get rid of him, to impeach him on national security reasons. Now, we could talk about the risks that the Democrats take with this impeachment thing.
You know...
Emoluments. So long, but I wanted to put a context around.
No, it's perfect. It's a perfect setup, and it's just every time somebody brings up emoluments within this context, I have to stop. You know, because
emoluments
was the lever for impeachment that came right into office with Trump. In other words, you know, before he's even taken his hand off the Bible. You know, or whatever, Satan's book, whatever they swear on. I don't know, anybody sniff around for the smell of sulfur at the time. But when right after the oath of office, he was, you know, because he walked in a priori with this condition, in violation of the Constitution's prohibition against emoluments and therefore impeachable. Like, I haven't finished lifting my hand to God yet, and I've already violated my oath of office. And consequently, impeached. I can be impeached. So, from the beginning, literally ab initio, they've been clamoring for impeachment. So that for them to act like, you know, now, well, we've been so demure over the last 2.5-3 years, and we've put up with just about everything. But this is just over the top. And then, you know, they characterize it in a certain way. Now, to be fair. We've only seen a transcript of the conversation, which is also a characterization until we hear the actual tape. We don't have the tape like we did with Vicki Newland, for example, yet. But I'm sure we will at some point. But it appears that, first of all, the thing he's accused of is part of his job description. Basically, you have a guy in my country that... decides with some other people that are in public office to take $5 billion or a succession of a fund of $5 billion spent over a decade or two to lay the groundwork for a coup d'etat, send over top officials from both parties to help stir up trouble on the streets of your capital, push through a coup d'etat that risks a world war with a nuclear power, and then once this is accomplished and you're placed in office, tell you, by the way, give my son a boatload of money. Now, you come to office and, you know, saying you're going to do away with corruption, and then somebody on the other side in that country where you installed this, these Nazis, by the way, they march at night with torches and they goose step and they openly invoke Bandera, who was, you know, a Hitler devotee. You know, you are elected to, as president of Ukraine, to clean out those people. And I call you up and say, look, we got some concerns here. We got a criminal investigation of the people that were here before that was thwarted by them and forced down the throat of your predecessors. Among the business that we're going to be doing together routinely, we would like you to look into this and give us whatever your investigation shows. Now, because that guy's going to run against me, I shouldn't do that. In other words, I'm the president of the United States, and I'm immune to criminal prosecution. And every day, everybody from the meter maid to whoever is threatening me with lawsuits and criminal actions and everything else. But this guy might run against me next year. He's immune. Leave him alone.
Yeah, this, you know, I think, Don, the way you have presented it would almost put you in the running for an Emmy. If not a Pulitzer for journalism. I think that was beautifully said, and it clarifying, and it makes the argument that I'm certain Trump in the upcoming campaign, the 2020 campaign, will make.
Right.
And I think, and you're right, but the thing that I would like to focus upon with that context that you have given is why the Democrats, or that the Democrats, have gone from this strategy of death by a thousand cuts towards Trump to now taking this great leap forward into the unknown of going for impeachment over what they are saying is now that Trump endangers the national security of the nation.
Right. Yeah, that's the background. You know, look, first of all.
Yeah, and let me just continue quickly. Now, in doing so, they have decided that Trump will not be the that Biden will not be the candidate.
Right, they're throwing him over, apparently, right?
Yeah, they've thrown him out. And that at this moment, it's Warren.
Okay? Yeah, they've
thrown him out. But the other thing is, the Democrats in the House of Representatives, even though there are over 200 of them who now say they are for some, and I've used this quote, form of impeachment or an impeachment process, it will divide them in ways that we have not seen among Democrats in decades.
Right.
Which means then that as a group that could, one, carry out impeachment, which is all about defeating Trump, they will be ineffective. I'm of the opinion that major players in the Democratic Party, especially the corporate Democrats, have more or less decided that they cannot defeat Trump in 2020. They will try to damage him. They will allow him to be reelected. They will try to take back the Senate and then proceed with impeachment and prepare the Democratic Party for 2024. Of course, all of this is a Hail Mary pass, I think, in the real sense, and I'll end here, as a national political force, the Democratic Party is almost dead.
Yeah, that's, you know, we'll see, but that's my read, too. Yeah. I think that's true. Mm-hmm. You know, let's go, first of all, to there's this idea that there are two opposing factions in the Democratic Party, within the Democratic Party. One, the neoliberal neocon faction, and the other, a left progressive, even socialist faction. This is the mythology that's bandied about.
And
it's supported by everybody.
That's a big myth. Yeah,
it's supported by everybody. You know, this is what the left corporate media, if you know, GE used to own me and I'm left, okay, if that can be left, says, you know, MSNBC. That's also what Fox and Trump say. You know, they accuse Democrats of being socialists also, and they'll accuse even the obvious neocon ones of being that, as opposed to the not-so-obvious neocon ones for people that didn't study history or philosophy or political science. So, I mean, it's obvious to anyone who's done any of those things what's going on, but that's not a lot of people anymore in this country, at least that have microphones. So you have, though, inside the Democratic Party, a choice was made a long time ago to follow a neocon policy. In fact, a lot of it developed inside the Democratic Party. I don't think that's been given proper credit in the public sphere. And so that choice carries with it sort of the dilemma, not the dilemma, but the direction that these things are going to follow at this point. The division with Trump and the elite really goes, but, you know, this is a guy who was coddled by the elite. He, on the one hand, leased his name to them, those who wanted to remain anonymous. You know, you got a couple billion-dollar developers that are putting a project together, and they don't want to put their names out there. They leased Trump's name, and it had value. You know, I put money into a movie, and I tell you, you know, yeah, here, make your movie, have your zombies, you know, vomit all over the Empire State Building or whatever. Just let Trump walk on in the third act, you know, with an entourage, you know, just walk through like the ballroom scene or whatever. And for, you know, for decades, he was, you know, sort of this kind of a media darling, which is why we're even talking about him. We would have never heard of him otherwise. He's a, you know, a good-sized developer. You know, guys like that own the Daily News and stuff. They're not president, you know, Mortimer Zuckerman or, you know, whatever. So instead, he's their darling until he starts to speak the heresy in 2015.
Absolutely.
And the heresy being that NATO is obsolete, that the Cold War policies towards Russia are obsolete, that the entire notion of the United States being in charge of the world is obsolete because it's too damned expensive, and it's a waste of money and time that could be better spent making money and saving time. And from that moment on, they turned
on.
Excuse
me, let me just add one other thing.
Yeah.
And that these wars of intervention in the Middle East
have
been fruitless, expensive, and we need to withdraw from that policy.
Exactly, that's right. The whole neocon program for relations with the world going forward, and particularly with respect to these you know, ongoing wars, permanent wars, he said, no good. This is bad. We're going to change this. He became, and he went from the darling of the media to persona non grata, and almost, you know, carpet bombing target on a daily basis. And so this is the environment that, you know, that shifted on this. And so coming into the Democratic Party, and he's a perfect setup for this too. You have the entire neocon and neoliberal establishment and partisan establishment, because after all, he also won as a Republican, so that activates a certain amount of opposition to the Democratic Party anyway. Yeah. But there's also the so-called left, because of the things he says and does, some of the policies and nationalist policies, the things that have to do with immigration, some of the things in his own personal history, like with the Central Park kids, you know, his full-page ad on that and his other similar, you know, voicings of that, that there's, you know, a natural sympathy among the actual left for an anti-Trump position on those things. If you're not paying attention to the role of imperialism in the total mix, this will determine that you are also part of the opposition. So where you supposedly have, you know, the left and the right wrestling inside the Democratic Party over this, you actually have a unity of identity in terms of opposition to Trump. And it's natural given the conditions that brought us here. This is
I mean you're absolutely brilliant this morning.
I had my coffee.
Yes. Let me just add a few other things.
Go for it.
And this was something that was emerging and evolving for some time, especially since the Great Recession of 2008, and the recovery of the corporations and banks, and the non-recovery of the working class, the lower middle classes, and the poor.
Yeah,
yes. So already you're having a profound political ideological divide reflecting the economic and class divide, which emerges after the 2008 Great Recession.
Right.
But in the midst of this, the center collapses and politics becomes an either-or zero-sum game. There is no room for compromise. The Democrats, not expecting to lose the 2016 election, lose it and then fight Trump in a way that says either him or us. There is no middle ground. And this is what we're looking at now. The collapse of the center, in a sense, reflects the emergence of a new kind of class conflict within American politics. I'm looking at the Rasmussen Daily polling. the only major polling firm that does this daily thing. And they were the ones that predicted, of all the major polls, that Trump would win in 2016. Well, right. on yesterday, their daily polling showed that Trump has a favorable rating among 51% of likely voters. He has an unfavorable rating among 47%. Now, polls are polls. They don't tell us a lot. But when you read that poll in the context of many other things, including the collapse of what Arthur Schlesinger called the vital center, what we're looking at is a deep division where I would argue the majority of the working class are on one side and are more favorable to Trump. That is within the working class, within the lower middle classes, among the poor, more of them see Trump favorably than see him unfavorably. He is most unfavored the higher on the economic and socioeconomic ladder you go. Among them, forms of identity politics and other distractions are favored in politics, and hence they are anti-Trump. They don't like his aesthetics. And as you point out, he has a history which is not so nice, to put it that way.
Right.
However, and this is our point, if you are talking about the long game, the long game is one that says, how do we shift the center of global political and economic power away from the neocons, the Western elites, towards a multipolar world? In that long game, Trump is a more favorable figure, a more favorable politician than any of the Democrats, including the so-called progressives.
Or Republicans, for that matter.
Or Republicans, for that matter.
I mean, what we're talking about here is just the same, and it's the same thing that, I don't know, I hate to use these terms, that the terms that have been used before, from ultra-leftist to Trotskyist to whatever, this is the same ground that these things have fallen on before, and that's the primary question, or the question of the primacy of imperialism, among
Absolutely.
All other things.
If
imperialism is permitted, then the imperialist system can feed. If the imperialist mm-hmm. system can feed, then you are confronting a global system when you go in to confront them inside your country or in a particular colony. If you cut the cord to the empire together, if you cut the throat of the empire, in essence, then the people of each of these countries have a much better shot at attaining liberation than they do if they're fighting the full power of the entire world, particularly if their natural allies are instead also feeding on them because they get a few crumbs thrown to them from the national or the global power structure, which has been the case for U.S. workers, at least since World War II, even earlier. When the United States stepped in and took over the empires, in essence, of the U.K. and France and Belgium and Japan and where else? I mean, not for nothing, take a look at Korea as one example. When Japan conquered South Korea and was sucking its blood for 20 years, when they signed the unconditional surrender, essentially they handed over the keys to the Japanese occupation bases in Korea to the U.S. military. That happened all over the world. And that flow of money started going to the people that own the United States, and they started throwing money at the working class here to shut up. Well, they intensified control in the colonies and elsewhere and put together the monster that the whole world faces now on the global stage. If we don't attack that first, then how the hell are we going to ever get liberation anywhere? And the problem is,
and you're right.
And the global context is this. While you have rising multipolarity, You have to push for that because that comes at the expense of hegemony. And that's hegemony right. is the lifeblood of global imperialism.
And that's it. And Trump as a disruptor. Anybody, yeah. as you say, who follows these events closely and carefully and critically recognizes that the main source of the opposition to Trump is not any of his personal issues, his alleged white supremacy, and he does walk that line. You know, he's on some days he's a racist, on yeah. other days he's not. But, you know, all of that taken
he's an American.
Into account. Yeah, all of that taken into account. The opposition to Trump has to do with this whole logic of imperial retreat from wars of intervention in the Middle East to his withdrawing or gesturing that he will withdraw from NATO to his more positive gesturing towards Kim Jong-un in North Korea or Xi Jinping in China or Putin in Russia. I mean, you know, all of this is disruptive of the system that emerged about 75 years ago after World War II. One last point.
Yep.
There is something going on in world financial, economic, and trading relations vis-a-vis the dollar.
Yep.
The dollar today as a international reserve currency is far less than what it was in 2016, 2010, certainly 2008.
Right.
The end of dollar hegemony is parallel to the rise of a multipolar world. So a multipolar world will see multiple currencies, what some call a basket of currencies.
Right.
The loss of American hegemony goes hand in hand with the loss of the exorbitant privileges of the dollar in world relationships, world trading and financial relationships. We are looking at the emergence of a whole new world. And as you point out, the long game, the fundamental game is to block the possibilities of imperial domination, imperial aggression, war, and so on are bad for working people. And so, you know, the Dems have staked their political fortunes on a myth of domestic, social, and economic benefits for the working class side by side with a renewed imperial hegemony in international relations. It does not work. It's not fooling a great number of American workers. And therefore, this so-called impeachment effort based on national security and all of that blase will fail. The Democrats have forced Nancy Pelosi, one of their better politicians, into an untenable position. Her hand has been significantly weakened, but the Democrats will not be able to take back the White House in 2020 and might lose the House itself, the House of Representatives itself.
We'll see how that goes. We've got like a minute left. I just want to say that, aside from thanking you for your excellent analysis, as always, the thing that I see here is that the intelligence agencies have got complete control. I guess they're assuming that they're going to program the 2020 election as a TV show. And what they've done by setting up the, you know, the hearings for impeachment is more or less scheduled, you know, TV time. So they'd have, you know, at least C-SPAN and then the news networks tuned in every day to whatever the narrative is going to get fed. So we'll be covering that as it goes on. Tony, thank you very much for your time, as always.
Thank you, Don. Appreciate it, man.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.